It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Mother's Day is almost here, and you can get her the most beautiful time-tested gift around. A watch she can wear every day for Movement. Whether mom's into classic dress watches, rare and refined ceramics, or tried-and-true bestsellers, Movement has something she'll love. And right now, you can save big on the best Mother's Day gift ever with up to 50% off site-wide during Movement's Mother's Day sale at MVMT.com. Again, that's up to 50% off at MVMT.com.
Welcome to Dig, a history podcast. In 1968, researchers found that one-third of all Puerto Rican women of childbearing age were surgically sterilized. This ignited the U.S. reproductive rights movement and the political demand to end forced sterilization in Puerto Rico. However, Puerto Rican women's reproduction has been tied to identity and nationalism since the United States assumed governance of Puerto Rico in 1898. Latinx have a long and complex history with birth control and surgical sterilization. Chicanas and Puerto Ricanas have been subjected episodically to unwanted sterilizations in state institutions and public clinics, while also struggling to access safe and affordable birth control, including surgical sterilization. The history of surgical sterilization and U.S. colonialism in Puerto Rico is complex and nuanced. Historian of reproductive politics and U.S. empire, Laura Briggs, summed it up well when she wrote, quote, "For liberals as much as conservatives, the future wealth or poverty, strength or weakness of the Puerto Rican nation was located symbolically and literally in women's wombs." I'm Elizabeth.
And I'm Marissa.
And we are your historians for this episode of Dig.
We want to pause to give a big thank you to all of our Patreon supporters, but especially our newest Augur level patron, Maggie. Maggie, your generosity is keeping this podcast going. Thank you. Listener, if you're not yet a patron, you can be. Go to patreon.com/digpodcast to learn more.
Our episodes in this series discuss eugenics and the various forms these, quote, scientific ideas have taken over the years. We sometimes talk about eugenics as something in the past, yet today's episode argues that, in fact, eugenics has made its way to the present day and affects both discourse and practice and who is deemed a fit body, a fit parent, or a fit citizen. Just recently, California prisons are said to have authorized sterilizations of nearly 150 female inmates between 2006 and 2010. The state paid doctors to perform tubal ligations that former inmates say were done under coercion.
In early 20th century America, social reformers, politicians, and scientists were successful in passing numerous sterilization laws across the country. These laws were based on theories of human heredity and the fear that conditions like poverty, criminality, feeble-mindedness, and even sexual deviance were inheritable traits. Those that advocated for sterilization viewed it as a necessary public service that would protect society and taxpayers from those deemed inferior or dangerous. The rise of medical professional experts and ideas about inheritance and deviance were important in shaping the ideas that ultimately affected public policy. In fact, historian Molly Ladd Taylor found that sterilization laws were actually fiscally expedient. Eugenic laws essentially became part of the bureaucracy of government social policy, with concerns over welfare costs and state institution budgets. These fiscal anxieties were just as important in getting sterilization laws passed as were fears about hereditary defects.
The first sterilization law passed in the United States was in Indiana in 1907. It applied mostly to men, and this eugenic statute was confined to institutional inmates classified as criminals, idiots, imbeciles, or rapists. However, as the physical embodiment of the future, women soon became the prime target of eugenic fears and controls. By 1910, Washington State, California, and Connecticut had their own sterilization laws on the books. By 1937, there were 31 states plus Puerto Rico that had eugenically motivated sterilization laws. Between roughly 1920 and 1937, there was a lot of upheaval regarding these laws, and in fact, the Indiana law, which had been the first in the nation, was repealed in 1921.
Codification through the federal government came in 1927. The U.S. Supreme Court handed down its first ruling, which established the precedent for compulsory sterilization in Buck v. Bell. This ruling held that a Virginia sterilization law was constitutional and did not violate the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. The statute provided for the sterilization of any inmate of a state institution when sterilization was considered to be in the best interest of the patient and of society.
Dr. Albert Sidney Priddy, superintendent of the Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded, wanted to test this new Virginia law. He filed a petition to sterilize Carrie Buck, an 18-year-old patient who he claimed had a mental age of 9. Priddy claimed that Buck's mother had a mental age of 8. He also claimed that Carrie's mother had a history of prostitution and immorality and had 3 children out of wedlock. Carrie was one of those children. She was adopted by the Dobbs family and lived with the Dobbses for 14 years before the family had her committed to the institution because they said she was incorrigible, was feeble-minded, and was pregnant with an illegitimate child.
But Carrie's pregnancy was not caused by any immorality on her own part. In the summer of 1923, while her adoptive mother was away, her adoptive mother's nephew raped Carrie. The family had her committed in order to save their reputation. Unfortunately for Carrie, Dr. Priddy had deemed Carrie's mother feeble-minded because of her alleged promiscuity, and so could use the hereditary argument to have Carrie committed and sterilized. Legal scholar Paul Lombardo sums it up this way, quote, Dr. Priddy's motives in proposing a sterilization program had less to do with thinning the ranks of the mentally and physically bereft than they had to do with satisfying his own strong and unique sense of morality. Priddy was obsessed with placing checks on sexuality and propagation. This obsession focused on eradication of the moral delinquents, whose unlicensed pregnancies he identified as the cause of poverty, crime, disease, and the myriad afflictions of society, end quote.
So let's just chew on that a little bit. This idea of promiscuity, or in the case of Carrie Buck, being the child of a supposedly promiscuous mother, was used as an indication of feeble-mindedness or deviancy. It played on this fear of the procreating mother who wasn't supported by a protective patriarch who would provide for her offspring. Essentially, if a woman dared to have sex before marriage, there must be something wrong with her. She must be feeble-minded to do something so sinful. And so the fear was that these feeble-minded women were just going to keep having babies while quote-unquote good, white, middle-class new women are out there riding their bicycles and going to college, and the fear would soon would be overrun by all these imbeciles, right?
Mm-hmm. Idiocracy, basically.
Right, right. That's a totally like eugenically
yeah.
motivated movie.
Super, yeah. Yep. Okay, so we've set the stage a bit for what's happening on the American mainland, so now let's turn to Puerto Rico. During the Great Depression of the 1930s, the island of Puerto Rico experienced high levels of poverty and unemployment, as much of the globe did. And of course, in mainland America too. Yet, a mainland fear of overpopulation in Puerto Rico drove a lot of the rhetoric around talk of stimulating the economy.
In the spring of 1932, the tension between the Puerto Rican Nationalist Party and U.S. colonist accounts of overpopulation on the island were played out in the pages of Margaret Sanger's Birth Control Review. The magazine published the article, Puerto Rico's Population Problem, by a mainland writer who warned that overpopulation on the island was out of control and that birth control should be administered by force if necessary. He also suggested the U.S. military would be forced to cull the island's population by bullet if its unruly population wasn't managed.
Jesus.
Yeah.
So just kill everyone?
Well, basically the fear was, they're going to become so overpopulated, they're basically going to be this mass horde, like,
yeah,
you know, scrounging for food and, like, coming over to America to scrounge for food, and the military will have to go in and, like, put down this uprising of the massive overpopulation.
Okay, so not just like, let's put them all online and shoot them.
But
okay.
Like, kind of postulating like, maybe that'll be the best way if you guys don't take care of your, you know, quote unquote problem.
Right.
We might be forced to come and take care of it for you kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So the secretary of the Nationalist Party shot back the next month in the pages of Birth Control Review, stating, quote, as a Puerto Rican who feels himself a freeman, I cannot help taking exception to the article. The author does not tell your readers that it's directly at the door of American capitalism that the blame must be laid for everything that's wrong with Puerto Rico today. He does not tell that in the 34 years of American intervention, the people have been dispossessed of their land and brought to the conditions of paupers. Our real problem lies in the actual control by American capital of practically all of our wealth. We may and we may not enact birth control laws. I think we would as soon as the American flag is lowered from our public buildings. The main thing is that it be lowered. The sooner, the better.
Right. So this is a really amazing example of how arguments over birth control, literally like what happens inside of women's wombs, is an argument about economics, poverty, nationality, and the U.S. political and military intervention in the island, right? All at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Mainland fears of overpopulation meant that the goal of the government was to, quote, fix unemployment and poverty by controlling family size. Demographers in the American Child Health Association figured that there were 176,650 too many children in Puerto Rico, and this led to extreme poverty. But those that were counting, quote, extra children glossed over the fact that the 1898 invasion of the island by U.S. forces had undermined the Puerto Rican economy.
In 1937, Law 116 was passed, which instituted a population control program modeled on many U.S. state eugenic programs. The law authorized a eugenics board that ruled on compulsory sterilizations. However, this board, unlike other eugenic boards in states like North Carolina or California, who sterilized literally tens of thousands of women and men, mostly people of color, I might add, the Puerto Rican Eugenics Board only ordered 97 involuntary sterilizations during its existence. So it begs the question as to why such a high amount of women of childbearing age were sterilized in Puerto Rico and along the East Coast diaspora in New York and Boston, if only 97 people were sterilized involuntarily by the Puerto Rican Eugenic Board. And that's where the answers get kind of complicated.
The population control program was part of a larger effort to catalyze the economic growth in Puerto Rico. U.S. government funds and contributions from private individuals supported the program. U.S. policy promoted the use of permanent sterilization and encouraged the practice through door-to-door campaigns with visits from health workers. Additionally, it was thought that if more women were sterilized, they'd have more time to work and thus help the economy, since women were considered part of the cheap labor force, as they always are. Industrial employers started favoring sterilized women for employment.
Clarence Gamble, the inheritor of the Gamble fortune, as in Procter & Gamble, so makers of things like Oral-B and Swiffer and Head & Shoulders. He was a devout eugenicist and worked effectively in the southern United States and in Puerto Rico to institute sterilization among those of the, quote, unfit, who in his mind inhibited social progress. Funded by Roosevelt's Puerto Rican Reconstruction Administration, Gamble hired and organized field workers to run birth control clinics, where they tested and practiced sterilization and new forms of birth control. Later, one of those forms was the pill, which we talk about in our episode, Birth Control Before Roe v. Wade. In the 1930s and 1940s, Gamble made sterilization mandatory in these clinics. If a woman had three living children, she would have to submit to being sterilized if she wanted to be admitted to the clinic to either give birth or have access to other health care.
In 1939, Roosevelt's Interdepartmental Committee on Puerto Rico proposed to lower the birth rate to at least the level of the death rate. They stated that, quote, all other endeavors to improve the health conditions of Puerto Rico must be organically tied to and made contingent upon effective birth control work, end quote. Laura Briggs finds that Gamble was frustrated in the efforts to fund massive state-sponsored sterilization campaigns. He heard the charges from the Catholic Church that there was a mass sterilization campaign against Puerto Rican women, and because it's Gamble and he's a eugenicist, he's like, oh, really? Well, where can I find these people and give them money to do more of this?
But archival letters show that there was no state-run systematic program for sterilization. In fact, Puerto Rican officials found that the demand for sterilization is very much a lay drive. So basically they're saying that officials are saying that the push for sterilization is actually being driven by women themselves. And because hospital beds were in such short supply, they were nervous that if Gamble or more state authorities started pushing a larger sterilization campaign, that the shortage of hospital beds would increase, right? So that's what Briggs finds, that Gamble was kind of frustrated with the amount of sterilization that he could kind of fund in Puerto Rico. However, Gamble established over 20 sterilization clinics throughout the mainland South and Midwest. The North Carolina Project was one of Gamble's most active. In 1949 alone, 249 people were sterilized at the clinic. African Americans were disproportionately targeted, and by 1964, African Americans accounted for 65% of all women sterilized in North Carolina.
Sterilization in Puerto Rico is not a binary event between coercion and choice. Struggles over birth control and sterilization on the island lived in a number of different and often incompatible beliefs. One, that poverty was caused by overpopulation. Two, that birth control was a genocidal American plot against Puerto Ricans. And three, that future prosperity of the island lay in smaller, modern, positive, eugenically designed families.
These competing ideas and beliefs lived among what Laura Briggs describes as the three competing nationalisms. The first was the nationalism of the Puerto Rican Nationalist Party, which envisioned a return to a pre-American Puerto Rico. This vision was of an agrarian utopia where strong patriarchs provided for healthy families. The movement identified women with motherhood, which in turn became the insides of nationhood. Within women, the mothers of the nation, future citizens were created, both physically and through culture. In the 1930s, the nationalist movement argued that the existence of birth control on the island was part of a U.S. federal policy of genocide, a position taken up by the Catholic Church throughout the next several decades. The church conducted a continuous crusade against sterilization and its supporters, saying that there was a genocidal mass sterilization policy being carried out in Puerto Rican clinics and hospitals.
A contrasting ideal of nationalism was the North American version that wanted protection against dark-skinned others. This was a nationalism derived from hard eugenics, which feared the reproduction of the lower classes. Puerto Ricans in general, and indeed all non-whites. So this is like your Reagan-era welfare queen type of argument.
Right.
You know, that that women of color are reproducing at, you know, rapid rates, like right. bunnies and...
And relying on the government for assistance.
Right.
And, yeah.
Yep.
And then this third competing nationalism was associated with missionaries, social workers, public health professionals, both Puerto Rican and North American. This nationalism argued that good families were key to the success of the island, so families needed to be proactive in limiting their size. This idea suggested that reducing large families, the number of irregular marriages, and the high maternal and infant mortality rates of rural subsistence farmers and the working class was paramount to improving the economic status of the island.
However, all of these positions were never mutually exclusive. The Nationalist Party and the Catholic bishops both opposed any type of birth control. However, many of the vocal feminist leaders and birth control supporters on the island were members of the nationalist movement, even though so much of the nationalist rhetoric focused on women as the mothers of the nation.
Briggs finds, what emerges from all this boundary blurring among supporters of birth control is not so much ideological muddiness as a group of strong-minded and pragmatic women, most but not all of whom were Puerto Rican, who championed birth control as an unmitigated good thing in the face of ongoing attempts by both colonialist and nationalist men to manipulate women and woman as mother as a symbol.
Many Puerto Rican feminist activists supported birth control and sterilization clinics, and many Puerto Rican women took advantage of them. In Ana Maria Garcia's 1982 film entitled La Aborración, which explores sterilization in Puerto Rico, one woman tells the interviewer, quote, "We didn't have much money, and the doctor told me I couldn't have many children. I talked to my husband and got sterilized. Nobody forced me," end quote. However, right after she says this, the film's voiceover says, quote, "In 1937, sterilization was approved by Governor Blanton Winship based on the principles of eugenics, advocating the breeding of the fit and weeding out of the unfit, namely the poor and unwhite," end quote. So in this account, any agency by Puerto Rican feminists or the woman herself is erased. Puerto Rican women's groups advocated for the passage of the sterilization bill in the first place, which also legalized other birth control methods like the diaphragm. So it's complicated. Access to healthcare was not easy on the island. Women did not have a lot of choices. Dr. Helen Rodriguez Trias, founder of the New York-based Coalition to End Sterilization Abuse, the CESA, aptly stated that, quote, "Women make choices based on alternatives, and there haven't been many alternatives in Puerto Rico," end quote. So it's an example of how women exert agency within constraints.
Right. However, the violence of forced sterilization was becoming glaringly clear to many mainland feminists and those concerned with social justice. The 1973 case Ralph v. Weinberger showcased these fears and the violence enacted on the poor and women of color through sterilization. Mary Alice Ralph was 14 and Minnie Ralph was 12 when they were sterilized by a federally funded program. Their mother, who was illiterate, signed an X on a piece of paper and expected that her daughters would receive birth control shots. Instead, the sisters were surgically sterilized. The Southern Poverty Law Center filed a lawsuit on behalf of the Ralph sisters, and the district court found that an estimated 100,000 to 150,000 poor people were sterilized annually under federally funded programs. Countless others were forced to agree to be sterilized when doctors threatened to terminate their welfare benefits unless they consented to surgical sterilization.
This is still a problem in social welfare today. So like in the foster care system, women can just, you know, continually have babies. Even there are some women who, by court order, their parental rights are terminated the second they give birth to a baby because they've had so many issues and like all of their children are addicted to drugs and so they immediately take them away. And so many people say, oh my God, it's so horrible that women like that can just continue to have children. Like, why can't we just sterilize them or whatever?
Yeah.
And it's like, because you can't. It reminded me of this idea that, oh, you can't get your welfare unless you cut the cord. Yeah. No, that's not what it's called.
Cut the tube.
Ralph V. Weinberger ruled that there was uncontroverted evidence that an indefinite number of poor people had been improperly coerced into accepting a sterilization operation. Through increases in Medicaid funding and the passage of the Family Planning Services and Population Research Act of 1970, the Nixon administration widely offered sterilization to low-income Americans, primarily women of color. Archives show that many of the doctors performing these procedures did not follow informed consent protocols and deemed the sterilizations, quote, involuntary as a matter of practice, end quote.
Dr. Pinkerton Uri found that thousands of Native American Indian women had been sterilized without their consent. Pinkerton Uri also found that the Indian Health Service had, quote, singled out full-blooded Indian women for sterilization procedures. In total, it is estimated that as many as 25 to 50% of Native American women were sterilized between 1970 and 1976. Iris Lopez explained how the film La Operación had both strengths and weaknesses when exploring sterilization in Puerto Rico during the 1950s and 1960s. She says, "The strength of this film is Garcia's powerful rendition of the history of sterilization." And I guess I should say, like, La Operación is, like, a pretty popular. It's like No Mas Bebes, mm-hmm. Which No Mas Bebes is also a documentary about Mexican women who were sterilized. Mm-hmm. And
against their will.
Against their will in the mm-hmm. 70s and 80s, I think that one looks at. So within this, like, kind of, I don't know, documentary realm or whatever, La Operación is pretty popular, right? But she's talking about the strengths and weaknesses of the film. And so Garcia's powerful rendition of the history of sterilization in Puerto Rico and her presentation of Puerto Rican women's stories. But because none of the women in the film clearly states that she was sterilized because she wanted fewer children, this lends itself to a pro-natalist interpretation that is natural and it is good for all women to have children. The only exception is an older Puerto Rican woman who excitedly inquires in the street about how she can get sterilized when she finds out that other women in her town have had La Operación. So Lopez says that in her own research based among Puerto Rican women in New York City, that woman's experience was more representative of the majority of the sterilized Puerto Rican women that she spoke with. La Operación represents most Puerto Rican women as victims of sterilization abuse, even though one woman in the film explicitly states that no one forced her to get sterilized, that essentially all these women are cast as helpless victims.
Briggs argues that the mainland feminist effort to articulate an anti-colonialist politics with women at the center inadvertently recapitulated the terms of a U.S. colonialist narrative. Puerto Rican women are victimized and need to be saved, end quote. Essentially, the coexistence of agency and constraints does not reduce anyone to a helpless victim, but also just because Puerto Rican women make decisions about their own fertility does not mean they're exercising complete reproductive freedom. So it goes back to the idea that Dr. Rodriguez Trias said, women make choices based on alternatives, and there haven't been many alternatives in Puerto Rico. Essentially, women do what they can with what they have. Quote, even though poor women are targets of population control, they do not follow population policy blindly. Most women exercise a certain degree of agency, end quote.
By 1976, the U.S. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, so HUE, which is now actually HHS, Health and Human Services, found that 37.4% of all women of childbearing age in Puerto Rico were sterilized. Astoundingly, a study in 1965 found that 95% of all women sterilized in New York City were Puerto Rican. So unquestionably, sterilization was unethically carried out in Puerto Rico as a form of population control, but not to ameliorate overpopulation, but Puerto Rico's dependence on the United States. Close examination shows how Puerto Rican women negotiated their own reproduction through sterilization to cope with poverty, lack of access to quality health care, and experiences with sexism.
The state's goal to lower the rate of population growth converged with Puerto Rican women's needs to control their fertility, increasing the rate of sterilization among Puerto Rican women on the island and in the United States. Puerto Rican women make reproductive decisions, but choosing between sterilization and continuing to have children under adverse conditions, or getting sterilized as a last resort after having more children than they desire, does not constitute full reproductive freedom or choice. Puerto Rican feminists are reframing the forced sterilization narrative and showing how, quote, the wombs of Puerto Rican women are intensely politicized, end quote, while writing the women themselves almost completely out of the picture.
Historian Johanna Schoen complicates our understanding of choice and coercion and how the state alternatively offered and denied poor women access to birth control, sterilization, and abortion. At the same time, thousands of poor women of color in Puerto Rico and the mainland, particularly the South, were being forcibly sterilized, while thousands more sought access to birth control or surgical sterilization because they wanted to control their fertility and they were denied. On the whole, it was difficult for poor women to access birth control on their own terms, to have reproductive rights. And so these complicated negotiations skirted the line between choice and coercion.
So basically, what you're saying is that the narrative of sterilization of women in Puerto Rico has been kind of like wielded by different groups and by feminists in mainland U.S., it's been wielded as like, oh, look at these poor Puerto Rican women. They wanted to have children. And, you know, the government came in and sterilized them. And then women in Puerto Rico are saying, no, like, we want the U.S. to get out of here. And so we have chosen, some of us have chosen to become sterilized because we want to have a stronger society. We want to have fewer kids. We want to work more. We want to have more options.
Right.
And so we made that choice because we want better lives for ourselves.
Right.
And then so really the truth is somewhere kind of in the middle.
Right.
Right.
Right. Right. Right. I mean, and that's also what Johanna Schoen really showed in the South as well, in sterilization in the South, that the sterilizations were coercive, yet it sometimes offered the only level of birth control or the only level of choice for many women. And so it's very complicated in an aspect where women of color were systematically also at the same time denied birth control on their own terms. This was sometimes the only choice they had.
Right. And that idea that there people lack authentic choice is a very important part of the reproductive justice
right.
movement. And it's such a critical thing to understand that, yeah, you know, given the constraints upon us, we have a choice. Like a lot of people, they just love this whole idea of like personal choice and personal responsibility and like, you know, make for yourself what you want to and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But we're all constrained by structural and cultural constraints.
Right.
And so do you have an authentic choice when you're choosing between just having kids endlessly forever and ever or being sterilized? You know, is that a real choice? Or, you know, would it actually be a real choice if you had a range of options where you could have birth control, and if you change your mind later, you can stop taking birth control,
yeah.
or you know, whatever.
Right.
It's
right.
A problem.
And after the fact too, I guess I don't want to gloss over the fact that there are many Puerto Rican women that also felt like they were lied to. So this idea of like your tubes being tied, that a lot of women actually thought that they could be untied,
mm-hmm.
right? That they're not called, you know. It's not called, it's tubal ligation, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, a lot of women understood that it could actually be reversed. You know, so there's like sticky elements in all of it.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like part of it is also that prejudicial, like that idea that, that Hispanic women like just want to have a million kids and all of this. And that's kind of probably where some of the mainland feminist stuff is coming from. Like, well, obviously all these Puerto Rican women wanted to have all these kids and then the government just came and took that option away from them. There's like a little bit of weird assumptions on their part.
Right. It's a very, it's so Laura Briggs is really arguing that it's interesting because a lot of mainland feminists really kind of unconsciously took on this conservative pro-natalist viewpoint
right.
that like the Catholic Church had been pushing since the 1930s,
right?
Right? That
yep.
that Americans are coming in and creating this genocidal mass extermination
mm-hmm.
of the future of Puerto Ricans.
Right.
And so that actually like left mainland leftists then kind of inadvertently took on that
mm-hmm.
that pronatalist masculinist
mm-hmm.
argument.
The same thing that people
right.
say about about places like Planned Parenthood that they are targeting people. Like,
right, right, right. Like, and so it just basically, it wipes the women out of the picture, right? That their choice is taken out of the picture, right? When in actuality, you know, Puerto Rican feminists were and women themselves were advocating for options, right?
Right.
And so in these quote-unquote alternatives, right, there weren't many alternatives, so these are the options that they had.
It would be interesting to know, like, for there to be a study to see, I mean, many of the women have passed away now, but to see, like, how many regretted it.
So it's interesting. So I think in 1976, there was a study done where they did talk to women, and it found that a high number of women regretted it. But later research into this has found that not exactly the case, that was one study. And like Iris Lopez, for example, granted, she was talking to a lot of people in New York City, but, you know, these women were coming and going, and it is this very circular, migration between the mainland and the island. But many women did not regret it. And then there's another example of Laura Briggs going into Puerto Rico, and she's, you know, researching women who are sterilized. And, you know, one of the women that she's talking to is like, why are American feminists so interested in us getting sterilized? Like, I got sterilized after my third child. My mom did too. It's just what we did. Mm-hmm. You know, so again, this kind of like writing like,
yeah,
the women out of it, you know, and having these larger issues these larger conversations of choice and consent and colonialism without talking to the actual or looking at the actual agency of women themselves.
Right. Yeah. I think it's like that's part of why it's important to have people be the center of their own stories, because
Right. We
can make people's stories be whatever we want them to be.
Right.
So
it's like white savior women, feminist women coming in and talking about the third world, you know, and mm-hmm. we must save the third world and this, that, and the other.
Right. It's very like white knighty.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, white, I don't know. What's a woman who's a white knight? A white knightress.
So that's all right. That we have for today.
Yeah. So please follow us on Twitter and Facebook and join our Facebook group, Dig History Pod Squad. Thank you for listening. And please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts if you liked our show. See ya.
Bye. Oh, Lord.
Sorry. I just had to stretch my pelvic floor.
In 1937, found that thousands of Native American Indian found that thousands Dr. Pink but not to ameliorate overpop I cannot say that word ameliorate. But not to ameliorate
but those that were counting extra children glossed over the fact that the
eight. So I'm sorry, extra, let's make it kind of sarcastic, like, okay. We're basically like they're calling people extra,
right? And not like, oh, you're so extra.
Yeah. No, not in a good way.
Too many children in Puerto Rico.
Wait.
What?
1,000. That's a comma.
Right.
You didn't say 1,000.
Oh, okay. I was like, yeah. That's all for today.
Oh, my God. I didn't write jack shit. Oh, That's going to be bad.
No, it's fine. I don't have an ending either. You say coercion so strangely. How many times are we going to say it for
a
this
lot.
Episode?
Coercion?
Coercion.
Coercion.
No, you're saying coercion. It's just coercion. Coercion. Like version, like the version of something.
I don't have to
coercion.
Say it the way you say it.
Okay, fine. Let's fight about it.